Now, on November 2nd, the Special Coordinating Committee began, held its meetings. It approved a message to the Shah saying that the U.S. would support him in anything he did to restore order, including the establishment of military government. Now, at the same time, Secretary Vance issued a statement that the Shah should restore order before he continued with liberalization, something to that effect. Now, did Vance or others discuss these messages with you before they were delivered? Do you recall?
Yeah, these message, a message would have been drafted and it would have been in Vance's hands before he went to that meeting. Mm-hmm. What happened to several of these messages during this period is they went up to the President, Brzezinski expressed his views, and maybe the three of them plus others met in the President's office, and you ended up with several major telegrams with this splitting of the difference and the sending of instructions that Bill Sullivan regarded as internally not coherent.
Mm-hmm.
Crackdown but liberalized. But this is where the Vance-Brzezinski differences became. And Carter, instead of coming down on one side or the other side, ended up, as I say, brokering the difference between them. And, it's almost if you had to list the policy failures of this period, one of them would focus on this fact that we were neither fish nor fowl. We were maybe doing two things at once that were inconsistent. We were telling the Shah to restore order, and that was Brzezinski's primary concern and focus, and his options concentrated on actions to accomplish that end. State Department George Ball were recommending broadening the base and a series of political actions, and they were given lip service to in the messages, but nobody put in the messages any kind of supporting detail or argument that would have given that part of the effort equal strength. So the commitment to broadening the governmental base was there, but what came out, the only action-related thing at the other end was tell the Shah that we'd behind him, tell the Shah to support him in restoring order. And so that's what came out as the action part of the telegram when it got to Tehran. What didn't come out was, why don't you suggest to the Shah at the same time that he begin to pave the way for... Come on in, Bill. Oh, okay.
Why don't we meet about 4 o'clock from now?
Rita's coming. She said she might be a couple minutes. I just dropped her off at her office. I was with a board meeting with her, so yeah, it may be a couple minutes. She may be a little late. But
were you personally uncomfortable with this approach at that time? What was your private assessment, or your personal assessment of the best thing you can recall?
I think our personal assessment again was that a military crackdown by itself was going to result in an unending confrontation to which there would be no constructive outcome. That the Shah couldn't ultimately prevail in any way that would be useful if he just relied on that. So what we said earlier was, the answer is a political answer, not a military answer. Okay, you've got demonstrations in the street. If you have to use some sort of police action to calm them down, as you cited from the earlier memo, that has to be coupled in some way with a political course of action which would give people who really didn't want blood in the streets but who opposed the Shah some way to go that would have drawn them out of the street.
Mm-hmm. During this period, the fall of 78, did you discuss the situation with Iranian government officials or private citizens who are Iranians? Did you have any contacts there?
I probably did not have many myself, certainly when you get in the middle of a crisis like this, the dealings with the ambassador or level the Secretary of State, or in this case you have the Secretary dealing with Ambassador Zadi, and you had Brzezinski dealing with him, and he was getting different signals. I did not have contact with the range of people that Kerry Sick did, for instance.
How much influence did you think that Zadi had on Brzezinski? Did you get a sense that there was much going on?
I had a sense that I think the book's document this now, but I had a brief. It's clear that Brzezinski was saying what Zadi wanted to hear the U.S. government say, and it emphasized the Brzezinski lines, which was to use the military. Remember, it was Zadi's father who had run the military, who had brought provided the environment within which the Shah was returned to Iran in 1953. So it's natural that his mind would have gone that way, and so it was big in its own way.
Okay. On November 8th, a few days after the Shah appointed a military government, and after protesters had burned down a number of buildings, including the British Embassy, Ambassador Sullivan sent a cable to Washington, which he titled, Thinking the Unthinkable. The implication of the message, I think, was that the current policy failed. The Shah should leave, and the U.S. should foster a coalition between younger, moderate military people and the secular opposition leaders. I think I'm reading it more or less in terms of what I think I'm fair about what he says. Now, how much of an impact did Sullivan's cable have at that time? Do you recall much discussion?
Well, of course, as any cable of that kind coming in the middle of a crisis, it was became the stimulus for further high-level meetings and discussions. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, it had an immediate impact.
Do you recall discussing it? Well, how would you what kind of impact do you think it had, or how would you assess the impact?
Well, I think one of the consequences, just bureaucratically, was the fact that, as Gary says in his book, the string of meetings in the NSC system at the White House level really date from about this point. Mm-hmm. What was it? What date does he?
November 8th. Oh, the cable?
No, the first meeting you mentioned a moment ago.
On November 2nd.
Second.
Yeah.
Well,
it's close.
But thereafter, the meetings were pretty, were more frequent, the White House level consideration was more frequent, more active, more continuous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you discuss this cable with Secretary Vance or with Christopher or Newsom or? That you can recall?
I just don't remember now.
I don't remember,
it didn't depend on me to get it there, and it came in to everybody at the same time, so he would have received it the same time I did. He didn't have to go and call his attention to something like that.
Okay. Now, also the cable, Sullivan's suggestion that such a coalition came to power, someone like Khomeini would play a Gandhi-like role, sort of aloof from the political process. To what extent, by this point, say in the fall or early winter, did State Department officials agree with that kind of an assessment of a Khomeini role in Iran? Wasn't even discussed at length.
I think that would have been consistent with the kind of analysis that would have been evolving in the department. Actually, the Sullivan telegram, in a strange way, is an articulation from the embassy of the analytical point of view that's been taken in the department. And I don't know what the symbiosis was in this process, but I don't know who led whom. You have to remember that the desk officer and embassy officers are on the telephone to each other all the time. So during the fall, the only communications were not those that are in print. The communications were through visitors going back and forth, discussions, telephone talks, official informal letters, all sorts of things. So who led whom in coming to these conclusions, I don't know. what's remarkable about the telegram is not that people were thinking this way. They've been thinking this way for weeks, if not several months. But what was a remarkable, the notable fact was that the ambassador put it down as a formal position, and that then moved the analytic, the policy community forward one step. It really forces the policy community to begin working from different premises, or at least to re-examine the premises that it had been working from. Remember, the earlier premise was from Sullivan, the Shah is in trouble, but the Shah will make it. Now, the premise is, it looks as if this may not be the case, that we at least have to think about the possibility that it won't be the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, later that same month, on November, before the month of Muharram began, the NSC held a special conference on Iran in the White House Situation Room, right from the basement there. Do you remember that meeting, or whether you attended it or not? Sick doesn't mention. Apparently, it was a very big meeting. A lot of high-level, middle-level officials involved in Iranian issues, people like Prep and so forth. And I think it doesn't mention whether you were there or not. I guess it was an all-day meeting on Iran.
I suspect I wasn't there.
One thing he says about the conference is that there were three major points of view that were articulated there. One was that the Shah would probably have to abdicate fairly early. Another was that he only had a 50-50 chance. And the second view was that the Shah only had a 50-50 chance of surviving.
What was the first one?
The first one, the first point of view articulated was that the Shah would probably have to abdicate fairly soon. The second being that he only had a 50-50 chance of surviving through 79. And the other view was that he would be able to rule for several more years. But after that, it was very, very, very murky. Would your views at that time have fallen somewhere among one of those three positions, that he would have had to advocate, or just had a very dim
chance? I think we still would have been in the middle. Your 50-50 applies to 1979. I think the thought was he was going to have to, certainly going to have to give up the full range of powers that he had mm-hmm. in the near future as part of a political accommodation. That would have been the way we would have formulated that.
Would any people at State arguing, maybe like Fleck or others, suggesting that he might have to abdicate soon? Was anybody coming around to that position by November? Or
well, he might have been closer to that than I don't.
Yeah.
But the focus wasn't on,
yeah,
again, on abdicating. The focus was on whether or not by some negotiation he would stay as a figurehead and he would bring some a regency group or something to power. I think we would have been focusing on how to preserve some sense of continuity rather than on abdication.
Okay. During this period, did you discuss Iran issues with Brzezinski from time to time? Did you have discussions?
I went to most of these meetings in the White House, so in that sense, yes, I don't remember a one-on-one. I don't think there would have been an occasion for a one-on-one conversation. Remember, we spent a lot of time in the same place together because, again, you recall what was going on through all of this, and that was that we had Egyptian and Israeli negotiating teams at Blair House and the Madison Hotel working on a peace treaty, and mm-hmm. we were in and out of the White House all the time because the president saw them on occasion and so on. So there was lots of contact, Iran meetings and these other affairs, probably. I was certainly in a group discussion with him on a number of occasions.
Okay, so we only have a few minutes left. Now, why don't we discuss the Ball report and then stop at that point. Now, in late November, Brzezinski asked George Ball to do a special study on Iran. Now, do you recall how this request came about?
I don't remember how the request came about, but there was this very strong school of thought. It was mentioned in the Sullivan telegram that there ought to be a political process here. And why, as Big says something in his book about why he did this. But,
but you were brought into the process in terms of deciding what the way
to do. That's one of those things that sort of comes down from on high.
Now, according to Brzezinski's memoirs, Secretary Vance was initially unenthusiastic about the whole notion of having Ball do a study. Do you recall that, or whether there was any reason for it?
I don't recall that. I don't know why.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that you discussed that with Ball from time to time during this period.
He's a very quick job. I mean, yeah. I remember mainly meeting with him that one Sunday night at this hotel that I mentioned to you. He'd reported within a very few days after that. So it wasn't a prolonged mission. It was just a very quick one.
Did he ask you for any advice at this meeting you discussed? Did he ask for your proposals or opinions?
Yeah, that was the purpose of the evening, and we talked extensively about various ideas of this kind.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the general approach that he took in his study or his paper that he presented to Carter?
That there was a need to, if the Shah could no longer govern as he had, there was a need to put something into place in the Iranian body politic that would perform the functions of a head of state, that this would necessarily have to be broadly representative, and whether the idea of the Regency Council or Council of Notables or whatever. And I can't remember whether it was in Ball's report or not, but at this time, of course, the idea of whether to meet the demands of the Khomeini group, the Shah would need to absent himself from Iran for a period of time and leave government in the hands of the Regency Council. And that was the collection of thoughts, I think, was what the Ball memo was built around.
Did you actually read it when he finished working on it? Did you read his report? I heard it was very tight, very closely controlled.
I don't remember now. Yeah. I mean, again, we talked through it and so on, and the ideas were there for what I had in my hand.
Okay. What was your evaluation of Ball's approach? How was it?
It was certainly consistent with ours, and therefore we thought it was a good report. As in a lot of political situations, you make proposals which you think will give you at least some chance of avoiding the worst scenario and accomplishing something of what you want. It wasn't that we thought that this would be an easy thing to do, or even that there was anything approaching a 50% chance of success, but again, it's like the Arab-Israeli experience, which was common for those of us involved in it. We never much had felt we had much more than a 25% chance of success. If we got that high, we were doing pretty well. That didn't mean you wouldn't try something to see whether you couldn't make it take hold. In some cases it did, in some cases it didn't. So you asked whether we thought it was a workable proposal. We thought it was something worth trying, whether it had a 50% chance of success. At that point, I suspect we thought that the odds were against any proposal, and the likelihood was that the Shah would go and Khomeini would come back. But we were still trying to see whether he could broker some accommodation.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss Ball's report or ideas with Brzezinski? You said you didn't talk with Brzezinski too much, but do you think Ball's report had any chance of being approved at the highest levels? By Carter or Brzezinski? Was it a very close call, or from your recollection?
Well, it was pretty clear Brzezinski wasn't going to like it, and that's what happened. I'm not quite so sure why Carter wasn't more responsive to it.
Well, this is probably a good time to stop, but continue with it. It all was in December, the next meeting.
Okay.